This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 258 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. If you're a fantasy football degenerate and you're also on Twitter, you probably noticed the hashtag SFB9 being used throughout the week. That SFB9 stands for the Scott Fish Bowl, and it's the ninth edition of it. Scott Fish works in the fantasy industry, and he puts together this massive league each year, and the number of participants just keeps getting bigger and bigger. This year, there's 1,200 people across 112 team leagues, and it's all for a great cause. Check out fantasycares.net and try and make a donation if you're able to. The Scott Fish Bowl is sort of the unofficial start to the fantasy football season, at least to me. And the league is always really interesting because Scott makes it interesting. There's crazy roster requirements and different scoring basically every single year. And he does it so that we all value each position pretty evenly. Or at the very least, the scoring is the way that it is in order for us to come up with a ton of different strategies. It's really the way that fantasy football should be played. This year, like most years, it's a superflex league. So you're looking to start, more than likely, two quarterbacks. But you're also getting first down bonuses for other positions, and then there are bonuses for milestones like 50 yards rushing, 100 yards rushing, 50 yards receiving, 100 yards receiving, and so on. I drew the 11 spot in my draft. I'd rather have one of the first four picks to secure one of the big four running backs, but at 11, you at least have the opportunity to be flexible. The thing is, these drafts are unpredictable. When there's no set strategy, which is a good thing, but when there's no obvious strategy to take, it makes reading the room really difficult. So when you're at the end of one of these drafts, which I'm at the 11th spot, it's a lot more difficult to predict what's about to happen in your draft, because strategies are all over the place. So that means sometimes you have to either play it really conservatively, or you've got to really feel good about your prediction as to how the draft is going to go down in the upcoming round. That brings me to round four of my draft, so the second pick of the fourth round. By this point, three quarterbacks were off the board. It was actually fewer than I thought would be off the board at that point, but I'm drafting with some pretty sharp people. So I sat there thinking to myself, what's this going to look like when things get back to me in the fifth round? There was a very good possibility that we'd see a quarterback run, because that's generally what happens in Superflex leagues. Now, realistically, in the late fifth round, I still could have and would have gotten a reasonable enough starting quarterback. But I also knew that I wouldn't have any flexibility with my fifth and sixth round picks. Because if I saw a quarterback run already happen, my mind would automatically think that I should go back-to-back quarterback picks in the fifth and sixth round, assuming that the quarterback run would continue. So with all that being said, I drafted Aaron Rodgers at the 402 spot. I know, I'm a fraud. One thought that I had in my head when I was making that pick was that it's probably going to be fairly difficult for a quarterback in this format, given the scoring, to really, really separate himself like Patrick Mahomes did last year. So there are only a handful of players in my eyes who have a shot at that kind of season. And I think Rodgers at least has that upside. And in a format with 1,200 teams, you're trying to find that type of ceiling. So that, combined with the fact that I was drafting a little scared, that I was fearful of a quarterback run, is why I got Aaron Rodgers. And to all you haters who think this is anti-brand, I would actually strongly disagree. As I always say, the late round quarterback strategy is not about a game of chicken. It's about a game of value. And it just so happens that historically, in single quarterback leagues, waiting on quarterback has brought the most value by far. And you can make the same argument in superflex leagues. Now, looking back, I kind of do regret the pick. That's going to happen in fantasy football. Not everything is going to come together in a draft the way that you intended it to come together. I like my team overall so far, but I do wish that I wouldn't have drafted so scared. Because roughly eight quarterbacks were selected between my picks, and I would have been perfectly fine with someone like Jared Goff as my QB1. The good news, though, is that I still got my man Chris Godwin in the fifth round and then Hunter Henry in the sixth. It's a format that favors tight ends. So I wouldn't have both of those dudes if I had been forced to pick a quarterback in the fifth or the sixth round. But I wanted to share my process to kick off today's mailbag show because I think that it's a good learning. It's important that you guys know that my drafts don't go flawlessly all the time. That it's still difficult to do this even when I'm analyzing this stuff every single day. And I wanted to obviously share that this wasn't really an off-brand pick. Though I most definitely enjoyed the jokes that people were throwing my way on Twitter after I announced that I drafted Aaron Rodgers. So that's the story. That's the logic. Let's move on to these mailbag questions. But before doing so, I wanted to remind you guys that the last major golf tournament of the year is upon us, and FanDuel is offering up something extra for a subpar performance. Enter the PGA Eagle or the PGA Stinger contest, and if any golfer in any of your lineups gets the lowest single round score of the tournament, you'll get a share of the $10,000 bonus on top of any regular contest winnings. For more info on the $10,000 best round bonus, visit FanDuel.com/best-round-bonus or download the app today. Eligibility restrictions apply. This first question is from Twitter from @funwithpronouns. Love how you explain positive regression versus progression, and I'm familiar with how you apply positive regression. But what stats do you prioritize to predict progression? So this question is essentially asking, how do you know when a player is going to get better in fantasy football as a player? And I'd start things off at a high level. You can separate this into two main buckets, player talent and team situation. The former is not going to come from just one singular statistic. It's a puzzle that you're fitting together. What type of prospect was the player? Was he drafted highly? How old is he now? Does he have a history of high performance? Obviously, the older the player, the less likely we're going to see true progression, but the more comfortable we're going to be when predicting how that player is going to perform. Team situation can also help us with this progression equation, because we know situation matters. As I always say, Alvin Kamara is one of the best running backs in the league, but he'd unlikely be this efficient and this good in a different offense. He landed in the right spot. I'm going to combine this question actually with another one that I got from @ztetlow717 that said, could you explain your process when projecting negative regression in a player who should also be seeing progression as well? So let's take Tyler Lockett as an example. He's got negative regression hitting him this year, but things should also progress. Not only is he 26 years old and he really hasn't played a ton in the NFL given injury, but there's now more opportunity to grab hold of a larger target share in Seattle's offense. Tyler Lockett has shown crazy efficiency. He's played all over the field and thrived in all areas. He's athletic, and he was a good prospect. Everything points to Tyler Lockett being good at football. So progression can happen with the team situation and opportunity and him just having another year of experience. So again, this is sort of answering both questions. Because Lockett has a lot going for him, he can progress. And that can easily negate any negative regression that's coming his way. And honestly, guys, in the end, projections are going to show regression. What I mean by that is, if a player had an outlier season, which Tyler Lockett had last year, his projection for the following season won't show an outlier season. It'll also show that regression. But the great part about building a projection is that you can automatically see if that regression will be negated by progression, whether it's through talent or situation. That's why Lockett is still a wide receiver too for me in 2019, at least a low-end one, because the opportunity should be there, and he's a really good wide receiver. Questions like these are tough to answer, but hopefully using this example allows the concepts to make a little bit more sense. This next question is from @ffdrewru. I have Kamara as a keeper in the 11th round of a 12-team full PPR league. What are your thoughts of me potentially trading my first and second round picks, I have the fifth pick, for the first overall pick and their last round pick? So anytime someone asks a pretty specific keeper question, which is what this is, I try to send them to my Evergreen podcast that I did last year on keeper selection process. It's episode 141. But I think this is a good example as to why I send people that way, which is why I wanted to talk about it on today's mailbag show. Your league clearly has keepers, but I don't know who those keepers are. If your league is keeping 50 total players, then clearly the 101 pick isn't as valuable as it would be in a regular league. Because instead of looking at Saquon Barkley or Ezekiel Elliott, you may be looking at Josh Jacobs or Leonard Fournette, or maybe even someone worse. So I can't give you a definitive answer to this question. My instinct says that this is probably a bad idea, but I have no idea given I don't know the keepers. My general process, though, for thinking about trades like this is to just choose players at those picks and see if it's a fair trade. Here's an extreme example of what I mean. If you're targeting Zeke with that 101 pick and you're giving up the fifth overall pick and then your second round pick, but at those picks you're only able to get like Tevin Coleman and Alshon Jeffrey or players of that caliber, then yes, do that trade. You're trading essentially Tevin Coleman and Alshon Jeffrey or those types of players for Ezekiel Elliott. Absolutely do that trade. But if you can get David Johnson and Juju Smith-Schuster at those picks, I don't think it's necessary. So it all depends on who you're getting at those picks, and because it's a keeper league, I can't answer that question, unfortunately. This next question is from @MattlesFF. How do you forecast rookies in your projections when it comes to things like yards per carry, touchdown rate, etc.? Do you favor previous year's production from other players from that team, or focus on relative college efficiency, or a mixture of both? Love the pod. Thanks. So I don't care all that much about college efficiency unless it's pretty extreme or obvious that a player is going to be used the same way in the NFL. There's a lot of noise to efficiency numbers in general, at least as it pertains to stickiness, so using numbers from a completely different league won't give you that much accuracy. One really easy approach to this is to just look at league-wide averages for a particular position, so the yards per carry at running back, let's say, and then adjust for the situation that you're projecting for. And you can do that by analyzing recent production by other backs in that system, offensive line changes, the quarterback play, and so on. But in the end, efficiency isn't going to move the needle like volume will. Just to use Tyler Lockett as an example again, that dude had one of the most efficient seasons, if not the most efficient season that we've ever seen from a wide receiver last year. But he only saw 70 targets. He scored 10 times, but he still finishes a low-end wide receiver 2 in points per game, despite being that efficient. I always try to think of efficiency at the extremes. Like, is the difference between 4.2 yards per carry and 4.5 yards per carry going to change how you view a player? Probably not. And projections are there to help you formulate opinions about players. So that projection doesn't really matter. It's not necessary to be absolutely precise, in my opinion. Projections are there to help you understand situation and better realize where there are values in drafts. This next question from Twitter says, lots of worry that Juju won't be good because he won't be able to handle number one coverage. Has there ever been a wide receiver who has flamed out when elevated to a number one role like this? Thanks, man. Love your work. Thanks, Sanjay. It's sort of a unique example. I looked back at previous top two round picks at wide receiver and I couldn't really find anyone who flamed out when given an opportunity like this. I just think that this type of narrative is insanely lazy and it's backed by nothing. And Sanjay, I'm not saying that you're backing this narrative. I just think that the narrative in general that's being thrown out there about Juju is lazy. People keep pointing to the Cincinnati game at the end of last year as to why Juju can't perform as the number one receiver. Because in that game, he caught just 5 of 10 targets for 37 yards. He did have a touchdown, but it wasn't anything special. He's played essentially 3 other games without Antonio Brown, though. One of them was a game where AB left early against New England in 2017, where Juju went for 114 yards on 6 catches. Then AB missed the rest of the regular season. In the following 2 games, Juju combined for 15 catches, 218 yards, and 2 touchdowns. So he scored in all but one of these contests without Antonio Brown, and he's hit 100-plus yards in 2 of them. Like, we do realize that almost every good wide receiver pretty much had to take over that position at some point, right? That they weren't always their team's top wide receiver. DeAndre Hopkins did it with Andre Johnson. Davante Adams had to do it with Jordy Nelson. Michael Thomas had Brandon Cooks there during his rookie year. Julio Jones had Roddy White. At some point, these Juju Smith-Schuster pessimists have to take a step back and realize that he's probably the best age-adjusted wide receiver of all time. That's not hyperbole. Juju doesn't turn 23 years old until late November. Entering the season, he'll have 2,343 yards receiving over his 2-year career. Only Josh Gordon and Randy Moss have more yards before turning 23. And Juju is fewer than 400 yards away from Randy Moss. That means that without an injury, he's going to pass Randy Moss on that list this year. And Juju also has the most catches before turning 23 in league history at wide receiver. Like, we've got to stop pretending that a player of this caliber can't be a number one receiver for an NFL team. It doesn't make any sense. And if you felt that way about other receivers when they had their opportunity to be the top guy, you missed out. Juju Smith-Schuster is worth his average draft position. He's going to be good. And all of you haters can lose at fantasy football with that type of bad process. This next question is from @trainofk. A lot of fantasy analysts have been talking about how they should have avoided David Johnson in 2018 due to all the signs pointing to a terrible offense as a lesson learned. What are the most important red flags for an offense that's about to fall off a cliff? Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think that you have to just be open to quarterbacks and offensive schemes failing. You should feel better about drafting running backs and offenses with good quarterbacks because we know the offense is less likely to fail. It doesn't mean that you have to do that with all of your picks. Like, I like Leonard Fournette this year. I think he's a good value. But I also recognize that the Jaguars' offense could realistically be pretty bad. But that's partially why he's being drafted where he's being drafted. You've really got to worry more about the super early round picks because that can sink your fantasy team. It's why I think you can make the argument that Saquon Barkley should be the 4th running back off the board this year. Because there's a lot more risk with the Giants offense compared to the Cowboys, Saints, and Panthers. And you might be sitting there saying, well, Saquon Barkley was a beast last year and the Giants weren't good offensively. But that's not totally true. Yes, Saquon Barkley was a beast, that's true. But the Giants were 17th in the league in yards last year, they were 14th in yards per play, and they were 21st in total offensive touchdowns. There's room for growth there, sure, but even with an improved offensive line, there's also room for them to be worse. There's no Odell Beckham for an entire season. He's gone. And Daniel Jones could see the field. So again, to get back to your question, you have to really understand that the floor for some of these running backs can be tied to scheme and quarterback. It's not to say that running backs can't be fantasy relevant if they're not in a good offense. But if there's a really good quarterback in that offense or a strong one, you can feel a lot safer about the pick. you should feel safer about the pick. And that's definitely something that was overlooked with David Johnson last year. This last question is from at BPA1991. Talking specific projection modeling for wide receiver and running back alike, how do you model projections where there is a new coaching staff or large turnover, i.e. Arizona, Oakland, and Miami? So the first thing that you can do is look at their projected wins total for the season. See how good that team is supposed to be. That can at least sort of dictate game script and pass to rush attempt ratio. And then you have to ask yourself if we have any history of the offensive play caller that'll be running the offenses that we're analyzing. So with Arizona, you've got Cliff Kingsbury. He'll likely have a pretty fast-paced offense just given his history. And there's a chance that it's pretty pass-heavy too. And then you just keep digging deeper and deeper until you get to that player level. As I've mentioned before on the show, with my projections, I take a top-down approach. I start at the team level before getting to the player level. And there are things that we can analyze at the team level to help better structure our player projections. I actually lied. That wasn't the last question. This is the last question from at Josh_Jenkins5. How would you recommend taking advantage of expert ADP data mismatch in a home league? Yeah, so if you see a mock draft from analysts, it's likely to not be a whole lot like a typical home league. In a home league, you'll have managers not really understanding roster construction and positional scarcity. And it's not their fault or anything. You've got to recognize that a lot of people playing fantasy football, they're not listening to podcasts like this one until August. They don't care about fantasy football until a week before their draft. Since they're less experienced, that means you'll have an easier time plucking value later in drafts. Let's say that you're drafting on Yahoo. You know that a lot of your home league is going to follow the ADP list or rankings list that's on the site when they're drafting, the rankings list that's in that draft room. So get a hold of that list, compare and contrast it to analyst rankings, and you'll start to find obvious values. That's how I generally approach home league drafts. Now, before giving you a send-off today, I wanted to add something about the episode that I dropped on Tuesday. I was naming some running backs and wide receivers that I like to break out this year, and I forgot to mention one of my favorites, and that's Rashad Penny. He actually fits the criteria quite well. His ADP is just higher than what I analyzed when I did the studies on spotting breakout players last year, and that's why he slipped through the cracks. But I love Rashad Penny this year. A lot of you hit me up on Twitter about it, and I need to be clear about it. I love Rashad Penny. I can dig into my love on later episodes of the show. For now, make sure you're subscribed to the Late Round Podcast by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you're on iTunes, do me a favor and leave a rating and review. And if you're on Twitter, hit me with a follow, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.